Journalists who report on organized crime in Mexico know it can be dangerous. Some reporters have lost their lives. Recently, the danger increased. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Journalists face a lot of insecurity in Mexico, but what's happening right now to reporters in the border state of Tamaulipas is unusually difficult. In late April, Mexican Marines killed the leader of a major cartel in the state, setting off a wave of crime that reporters are struggling to chronicle without being targeted themselves. And the story matters to the U.S. because the fight is in Reynosa, a city filled with assembly line factories that provide the U.S. with items like furniture, electronics, and computers. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon has the story.
Reynosa has never been an easy place to be a journalist. The sprawling factory town sits across the Rio Grande from McAllen, Texas. It's often been a staging ground for battles within organized crime, where civilians become collateral damage, and lately where journalists like Paco Rojas are often threatened.
We are living in the middle of that war. It's like a war here.
We are living in the middle of that war. It's like a war out there, he says. He said the public wants to know what's going on. In late April, Mexican Marines killed Juan Loisa Salinas, local head of the Gulf Cartel. Buildings were torched, cars were set on fire. Rival factions fought it out on the streets and told journalists stay away from the crime scenes. At least 26 people have been killed since.
We're asking to the government, hey, come on, what's happening with you? Respond to this situation.
Rojas says he's now taking self-censorship to new levels. Until recently, he'd at least hint at which group was allegedly involved in a crime, which unit of police or military were sent to investigate.
So I live here. I know people. And they know me too. And they me respetan porque me conocen mi trabajo.
They respect you because you know your work.
Yeah.
That respect protects him, but only to a point, he says. The government of Tamaulipas has pledged to protect journalists, but Rojas isn't waiting. He's using different routes, keeping his hands visible while out reporting. They're fighting in the streets, anytime, anywhere, he says. If I keep my hands visible, they know I don't have a weapon. In late April and May, the state closed or raided casinos and bars, two places where organized crime launders cash. His reporting walked a fine line on a story that's clearly in the public's interest. The situation prompted the state's governor, Francisco García Cabeza de Vaca, to make a televised address.
Estoy consciente de las acciones de violencia que hemos visto en este tiempo.
These are rough times, he said. He then castigated previous state governments for not going after illicit money. Aldo Hernandez is one of the governor's spokesmen.
The governor, his strategy is to fight the income of the organized crime here, not only fighting with bullets.
The taxi driver who asked not to be named praised that strategy, saying that may stop the insecurity journalists are trying to cover.
And you never know when it's going to happen or where.
Again, Reynosa journalist Paco Rojas.
I get out of my house in the morning. Please God, let me get back to my home. And so many people say the same thing.
Upriver in Ciudad Juarez, the newspaper El Norte was shut down after a 27-year run after its owner, Oscar Cantú Murguía, concluded he couldn't deal with that kind of risk. The single-word headline on April 2nd was Adios. He explained the decision was the direct result of continuing threats and unpunished killings of journalists. Part of a fear, Paco Rojas says, has become pronounced on the border since March, when three journalists across Mexico were killed, including one who was a contributor to the now-shuttered El Norte. I'm Lauren Madelon in Reynosa, Mexico.
In California, prototypes of President Trump's border wall are scheduled to go up in Otay Mesa over the summer, but environmentalists hope to stop construction. They're suing the government because they say the wall will affect endangered species. Jean Guerrero of KPBS has details.
Prototypes for Trump's border wall are scheduled to be built this summer in the mountains near Otay Mesa, home to endangered species like the Kino checkerspot butterfly and fragile ecosystems like vernal pools. Brian Segui of the Center for Biological Diversity says his organization is suing the government for failing to prepare or publish the legally required environmental analysis.
We're now at the threshold of these major construction projects being undertaken at the border, and there's just no information. There's no environmental analysis that's been done.
Both the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection declined to comment. In addition to the prototypes, Trump plans to rebuild 14 miles of border fence stretching inland from Imperial Beach. Sagi says that also requires environmental analysis.
Obviously, a lot of damage has already been done there. But the reconstruction of that double-layered border wall would still be a massive construction undertaking. It would have a large footprint.
Construction on much of the existing border fence circumvented environmental laws. The Real ID Act of 2005 gave Homeland Security the power to waive any laws deemed necessary to ensure quick construction of border barriers in the name of national security. Sagi says Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly could also invoke those waivers.
We would challenge those waivers, but it would not be at all surprising for this administration to use that.
The agencies have until September 5th to respond to the claims in the lawsuit. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
In the heart of one of San Antonio's oldest parks is a tall Confederate monument erected 30 years after the Civil War. Most visitors to Travis Park only pay passing attention to it, but in the last 2 years, the 40-foot structure has become the subject of scrutiny as people across the U.S. question whether Confederate landmarks are an offensive reminder of past racism against people of color. Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios tells us at least two city council members would like to see the monument moved to a museum, and community support for that option may be growing.
The 147-year-old Travis Park is near the northeastern edge of downtown San Antonio. It's nestled between two churches and a towering office building. Here, people often do group yoga, play with a giant chess set, or check out a book from a city-operated kiosk. In the center is a vertical monument about two stories high. An inscription says, "Lest we forget our Confederate dead." At the top is an unnamed Confederate soldier with a finger pointing upward.
And the reason that he's got his finger pointed in the sky, that's typical for monuments, that he's pointing to heaven, that he wants to go and be with his fellow soldiers.
John McAmmon with the Sons of Confederate Veterans says the monument is a tribute to unnamed Confederate soldiers who died in the war.
This is not to a specific individual. This is for people that are dead and their graves aren't marked. This is a marker for the buried soldiers that we don't know where they are.
The monument was erected in 1899 by the Daughters of the Confederacy. Its construction was met with some resistance. City records from the Office of Historic Preservation say an 1898 article by the San Antonio Daily Light stated the monument, quote, would likely be the scoff of future generations. 118 years later, people are calling Confederate monuments a symbol of racism in a divided country. Mike Lowe is the organizer of SATX4. It's a group that bills itself as exposing systemic racism.
This memorial, I don't care if it was Jesus up there, represents a system and a way of life that thrived off of oppression.
Lowe says it does not belong in a public space.
This open space public reminder of what that represents is offensive to my community and my ancestors.
The ire towards the landmark has gained the attention of at least two San Antonio council members. District 1 Councilman Roberto Trevino and Cruz Shaw of District 2 want to introduce proposals to move it. Shaw says it should be placed in a museum.
Monuments like that need to be placed in a historical facility, i.e. a museum, maybe a college, a university, something that could represent history. So we're not erasing history.
Trevino says he wants the city to be welcoming and inclusive.
Monuments of power can put a strain on certain parts of our community, and we don't want to be helping or contributing with our city amenities like parks.
Councilman Trevino has asked the city's Department of Culture and Creative Development and Office of Historic Preservation to weigh in on what to do. He says the monument is a piece of military history, and he's asked the city's Department of Military Affairs to help direct the conversation.
The Office of Military Affairs has been working on some great things, like making sure that we document and really unify all our military monuments throughout the city.
Shaw and Trevino still need three other council members to formally sign on to what's called a council consideration request, which is still being drafted. Besides a museum, another option being considered is adding historical markers around the monument for context, or things could remain as they are. 2 years ago, former San Antonio Mayor Ivy Taylor, the city's first African-American mayor, was against removing the monument, saying history shouldn't be destroyed. consideration never came to council. Newly elected Mayor Ron Nirenberg seems to be more on board. Nirenberg says that he welcomes a community conversation. John McAmmon with the Sons of Confederate Veterans says he believes moving the monument will be met with much opposition, especially from veterans.
To go in and to start removing history is a dangerous thing, and I really believe that we need to look at our history and include all of it.
Mike Lowe with SATX4 says you can't sanitize evil.
This right here is a reminder of everything that the system was designed to reflect as it related to white supremacy. I don't support that at all.
When the city council returns in August, it's expected to have a full docket with the requests of new council members. Trevino and Shaw are confident they have the support of other council members to begin the discussion. In San Antonio, Joey Palacios reporting.
Coming up on Fronteras, for refugee students, getting through school can be tough. That's why a Dallas couple says they're helping kids in the neighborhood.
I feel like it's a tricky situation when you come here and may have been at the top of your class in another country and you come here and suddenly you're at the bottom.
We'll explore that story and respecting the pronunciations of Hispanic names when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras. A person's name can be a point of contention, especially when it's pronounced incorrectly. If your name is long, maybe you shorten it. Or if you're Hispanic, perhaps you don't mind an anglicized version. Take Perez instead of Perez. I spoke to writer, performer, and social activist Irma Herrera, whose one-woman show, Why Would I Mispronounce My Own Name?, encourages people to embrace the names with which they were blessed. So pronounce your name for us the way, of course, you say your name.
Irma Herrera. Often people look startled when I say Irma Herrera, and their response is, I didn't catch that. And I understand, so I say, I'll repeat it for you. My name is Irma Herrera. How do you spell it? I say, better if I pronounce it and you repeat after me, because it may not sound like it looks to you. Because when people see I-R-M-A, they say Irma. And if they see H-E-R-R-E-R-A, they say Herrera, and in Spanish, the H is silent. But of course, many people do pronounce the H. For example, you hear people refer to their name as Hernandez. So part of it is simply people don't know. But a common response I get back from people when I say, just try, it's Irma Herrera. Oh, I'm not good with languages. I can't roll my R's. It's like, really, you can. Just give it a try. And they do. And when they do, they find they can closely approximate it.
I'm curious, you know, you grew up in this little town, Alice, Texas, which you described as being very segregated. Were you ever embarrassed by your name?
Oh, come see my play, and I tell a particular story about mispronouncing my own name and how that felt. Until I started public schools. I went to a segregated parochial school until I went to a public school and had Anglo teachers. It was never an issue because we were taught by Filipino and Spanish nuns. And growing up in Texas, when the teachers called me Irma, I don't think that I corrected them. And this is so true of so many people that as they became older, as they became more politically aware about the differences and discrimination, that some folks reclaimed their name and said, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm not Grace, I'm Graciela. But it's not just an issue for Latinos or people with Spanish names. If your name is Alexander and that's what you want to be called and someone calls you Alex, you tell them, no, it's Alexander. And generally we afford those people that respect. And I have a beef with National Public Radio and with almost all radio stations, and that is the great attention they pay to saying French names. No one would dream of calling Jacques Chirac, the former French president. It's like they say Jacques Chirac. But you have Spanish names, and they often get mispronounced. And I have one incident in particular that always sticks out in my mind, and that is Federico Peña, who is former Secretary of Transportation and then Energy. So the newscasters would often call him Frederico Pina. Well, Pina's a pineapple, and that's not his last name. It's Peña, and I would yell at the radio and say, where are the editors? Why aren't people saying to the on-air newscasters, you need to learn those pronunciations as well? So there's this thing I have about Spanish being viewed as a low-status language as compared to others, in particular French. But there's no excuse for it.
So do you have a book planned
with
your experiences?
I do. I've been collecting stories, and I plan to call my book Tell Me Your Name, which was the original name of my play. I don't know when the book will see the light of day, but one of the tremendous pleasures and rewards of this project is the stories that people share with me. I send a little radio clip from a prospective program at my local affiliate station to a woman that I know who's of Hungarian ancestry. She was actually born in Hungary. And it was about a woman's Polish name being mispronounced. And she said, my parents gave us distinctive Hungarian first names. In case we were displaced during the war, they would know what country to return us to. So there's so much that goes into a person's name that we don't know about. And therefore, it really is about respecting an individual to take the time to learn what their name is and how to say it.
Irma Herrera's one-woman show is called Why Would I Mispronounce My Own Name? Now to North Texas. In one Dallas neighborhood, a young couple is helping refugee students navigate their new lives in America. KERA's Stella Chavez checks in with the husband and wife team who spend most of their days working with refugee kids. Then at night, they open their home to them.
Drop by Alex and Laura Laywell's apartment and you'll likely find several kids hanging out. The Laywells and a group of teenagers are sitting at the dining room table playing Ultimate Werewolf. In this card game, everyone assumes a different role, a villager, or a vampire, or a werewolf. Players have to figure out which one of them is the werewolf.
If there is only one werewolf, you may look at a card from the center.
After the game and some pizza, they'll watch a movie, Little Giants. One of several movie nights the Laywells host throughout the year.
My mom is there!
For the past couple of years, the Laywells have opened their apartment to help refugee kids in Vickery Meadow. People from all over the world live in this densely populated neighborhood in northeast Dallas. For the kids who live here, Alex and Laura Laywell aren't just neighbors. They're friends, teachers, and counselors. For 17-year-old Sue Kang, the Laywells are also like parents.
When I was having problems, I couldn't tell nobody I was having a hard time, but they see that something was wrong, so they speak up and they talk to me and they would talk about it and we cry together.
Sue used to go to the Laywells every day to do homework. She says thanks to them, she's become a better student at Conrad High School.
They helped me with a lot of stuff in school. They helped me with my sport, and they helped me with my homework to get my grades up. They also helped me with reading so I don't fall behind in reading.
The Laywells, who are both 27, met in high school. When they started dating, they realized they shared a passion for working with refugees. Alex learned about Vickery Meadow from his sister. He felt an immediate connection to the neighborhood. During his last semester at the University of North Texas, he took classes online so he could live there. Alex started working for Hart House, an after-school program in the neighborhood. Laura started volunteering there and became familiar with some of the issues Vickery Meadow teens face.
Some of the normal issues that I guess American teenagers would go through are amplified, like body image or dating, and any issue that's normal for an American teen, they also are walking through that. But on top of that, with a different cultural background and their families believing different things.
Today, Laura's a third grade teacher at nearby Jack Lowe Elementary. And this summer, she's working for a program that helps Vickery Meadow kids stay in school. Alex is now a volunteer coordinator at International Rescue Committee, which helps resettle refugees in Dallas. For both of them, opening the doors to their home felt natural.
When we were dating, we talked a lot about we wanted our home to be like open and just kind of a place for students to come over, and that was something that bonded Alex and I together.
The couple has also been guided by their faith. As practicing Christians, they say it's their duty to help others. Alex says he wants the kids who live here to have as many opportunities as he did growing up.
I want them to be able to do things academically, or just simple things like go to Mavericks games or, you know, have movie nights.
The kids even attended the couple's wedding. Today, the Laywells take the kids everywhere, to the grocery store, community meetings, and their parents' house.
The girls and I love to kick Alex out and do girls' nights where we just get to talk about what life is like as a girl and share and, like, make face masks out of oatmeal.
Alex Laywell says people always compliment them on what they're doing for the kids.
I honestly feel like we get just as much or more out of it. And, like, though they might be, you know, 7th through 12th grade or whatever age they are, they've certainly shaped every aspect of our lives.
The Laywells say it's hard to imagine their lives without these kids in it. For Fronteras, I'm Stella Chavez.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Chiranga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.